Hey everyone, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is a bonus episode of the VA Foodcast. We are still recording remotely, but there will be better audio coming next week. For today, we called up Edward Lee, chef and owner of 610 Magnolia, Milkwood, and Whiskey Dry in Louisville, as well as Succotash in Washington, D.C. Ed has been on the front lines trying to address some of the devastation that has hit the restaurant industry in the last couple of weeks. He started by turning 610 Magnolia into something like a soup kitchen, preparing and serving hundreds of meals a night for the hospitality community through his nonprofit, The Lee Initiative. Ed's is one of many heroic efforts happening across the nation right now, and we are going to do our best to continue bringing you the stories of those being affected by what's going on, both on the podcast and in our coverage on bonapetit.com. There's a link in today's show notes that will direct you to our Restaurant Diaries feature that we've been updating online every day with new and evolving news regarding the struggles and challenges facing restaurants across the nation. For now, we are very grateful to Ed for all he's been doing and for taking the time to talk to us. One note, however, there are a few curse words scattered throughout the interview, so if anyone sensitive is listening, maybe save this for your own ears. All right, here's Ed Lee. Ed Lee, first and foremost, how are you doing?
Under the circumstances, I'm holding it together as best I can.
And where are you right now?
Louisville.
Oh, so you're back in Louisville. Mm-hmm. Have you been to Louisville all the time or back and forth from D.C.?
I was just telling your producer, my car is actually at JFK Airport and I don't know what to do with it.
No.
I drove to the airport, flew somewhere, thinking I'd be back. I'm now, you know, somehow got back to Louisville. I got to get my car out and I just don't know what to do. I don't want to fly to JFK just to get my car. But so anyway, just amongst the many other crazy things that's happening.
I had not thought about short-term parking at airports as one of the side effects of this whole crisis, but I guess that is one. Hopefully you're not racking up some serious bills there.
Yeah, I'm hoping there's a relief package on the car parking, but we'll see.
Yeah, keep hoping. So what I would like to do is maybe today's Wednesday, the 25th, March yes. 25th. How about we rewind 2 weeks to mm-hmm. March 11th? And that was the night that I think it coalesced for a lot of people how serious this was going to be. It's when the NBA canceled their season. It's when Tom Hanks tweeted that he and his wife had tested positive for coronavirus. What were you doing that night? And what have the weeks been like since?
Obviously, I was still in Louisville and, you know, to be quite honest, business was usual. That coming weekend, the 14th and 15th, we had a really busy weekend. Everything was kind of running normal. And in some ways, being in Kentucky, you live in a bit of a bubble. Mm-hmm. And things always trickle down and they're a little delayed. And there's always this perception of that's happening out in the world. It'll take a few weeks before things trickle down to us. And it was very surreal watching it all. And we thought, great, but we've got a few weeks to prepare for this. And we'll figure out what's going to happen. But we had a few cancellations that coming weekend. But other than that, things were normal. You know, we were already hearing about the lockdowns and the shutdowns. And I thought, it's going to happen in Kentucky. It's just going to maybe take a little longer. The fact is, it didn't take any longer. It happened on the 15th of March, which was, right after Ohio, right after Illinois, right after California.
Was it a state order that restaurants had to close?
It was a state order shutdown at the end of, it was like sundown on the 15th, or like after service on the 15th, which was that Sunday.
So what was the first thing that went through your head when you heard that? What do you do?
You know, it's all those things, right? It was shock, panic, depression. This isn't happening. What's, you know, I think for myself and for many people, the first thing that happens is a very selfish reaction. It's like, what's going to happen to me? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to my finances? What's going to happen to me? And, you know, I am very fortunate to have an incredible wife and an incredible child and a family that doesn't let me wallow for very long in my shit. And quickly she was like, it's not about you. Like there's more out there. And it was literally about an hour of just being depressed. And it was then like, what do we do? What do we do with the hundreds of people that I employ?
How many properties do you own and how many employees through those properties?
So three in Louisville, which have about a total of, you know, roughly 200 employees, and then two in DC, which have about roughly 200 employees. So 400, you know, all told. And DC was shut down at the same time as well. So what
do you do? I mean, do you have to send an email out saying, hey, everybody, you don't have jobs anymore? Or what was that process?
That was exactly the process. It was, and I think most chefs did the same thing. All of my long-term employees, all of the people that were on salary with me, I said, you are safe for now. And this is, you have to understand, this is an hour. I mean, we hadn't even, I mean, the ovens were still hot. You know, I mean, we still had microgreens in my walk-in, and I'm sending emails out saying, you know, and the first thing is, I don't know the future, but I am your leader. I'm the one that runs this company, and I'm going to bear the burden. The first thing I said was, I am suspending my pay, period. That's the first thing. Second thing was, anyone who is on salary is safe for now and for as long as I can do financially.
When you say people who are on salary within a restaurant group like yours, what does that mean? Does that mean management typically, or what sort of positions are on salary?
Management, head chefs, longtime chefs, managers, floor managers, you know, people of that nature. Basically, anyone that's been with me for more than 2 years is probably on salary. So we keep them safe, and anyone that is an hourly, which means that someone who works part-time or gets paid by the hourly was laid off just like that, without warning, without notice, without any, you know, I mean, we felt it coming, but there was no preparation. There was no time. There was no soft landing. It just happened. I said, as best as I can, anyone who needs to stay on payroll, make a case for yourself, because there is no work at this point. It's just coming out of my pocket. Yeah. Make a case for yourself, and I will try my best. And so, you know, the wheels in my head start to spin and say, well, how do I possibly keep some of these people employed? What do we do? Do we do takeout meals? We had about 2 hours to pivot and say, well, what can we do? So Monday morning, we started to just transform all our kitchens and say, which restaurants are closed? Which ones are going to do takeout? How many people can we employ? How many people can we save? And amidst that, my director of operations for my nonprofit, the Lee Initiative, is a woman named Lindsay Osasek. And she is working with Maker's Mark, because we have a nonprofit, the Women's Chef Initiative. So our partner is Maker's Mark. And we do a very lovely program. But it is a nonprofit that employs two people. It's two people and myself, like on an email every now and then. And she called me Monday afternoon and said, because what we started doing on Monday was turning 610 Magnolia, shutting it down, turning it into a relief kitchen. And we were going to feed our staff, the people that we knew we had to lay off, and we were going to give them all the leftover food and everything. And she called me and said, Makers heard what you're doing. They want to know if we can expand this program. And I mean, this is less than 12 hours after we shut down our restaurants. So we had an emergency meeting. We called them. I took the next 4 hours and wrote out all the logistics. Lindsay got together and just called everyone she knew at Makers. We had this crazy meeting, and we said, you realize that this is not a Louisville problem, that this is not a New York problem or DC. This is going to be a nationwide problem. And all of these hourly workers and everyone I talked to did the same thing. I'm going to save my salaried people. I have to lay off my hourlies. And we just said, I don't know how many, but these are millions of people across the nation that are all of a sudden without a job. And these are the people that live week to week, that rely on their paycheck. What's going to happen to them? I mean, we just went from being a family, a community, a restaurant group that was expanding to, oh, we got to turn our backs on these people now and lay them off and just protect our own. And I, for one, said, I can't imagine these people who get forgotten. And in 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks, we call them back and go, hey, remember us? You want to come work for us again? They are not going to come back and work for us. And if they do, they're not going to do it with the same passion, loyalty, and verve if we turn our backs on them now. And so I said, we have to do something. I don't know what it is, but we have to do something. Last year, when the TSA workers were laid off, we turned our kitchen into a relief kitchen, and we fed them for about 3 weeks. And we had that business model already in place. So I said, why don't we just do that? It's the same exact thing. It's kitchen. Everyone comes at night. We give them box meals to go. It's hot. It's free. And we give them a bag of groceries and supplies. Except instead of TSA workers, it's now our own.
Maker said that they would cover the cost of the groceries or help pay for some of the people who would work, or what was their involvement?
Yeah, they basically gave us the seed money. You know, we quickly priced it out and said, okay, if I put four people in the kitchen, two people in the front of the house, this is how many meals I can do every day. And it calculated out to about 250 to 300, you know, depending on the market. And if we price it out that way, look at the meals, the cost, everything, this is how much it costs. And Maker said, fine, we can give you enough to run it for 2 weeks.
To run just Magnolia or the other restaurants, or what was the scale?
Just Magnolia for 2 weeks. They said, on Monday, they said, we have enough money to give you for 1 week. And I said, I'll take it. That's not bad. I'll take anything. So I took their money. We did it on Tuesday night was the first night that we did it. We were going to feed 250 people, 400 people lined up. Families, you know, grown men, people we knew, you know, lined up. We opened the kitchen at 5 p.m. and people came at 4:15 to line up.
Wow.
Because they knew that they were panicking. And Maker, the reps from Makers were there, and they saw it. And they saw, you know, it wasn't just about the food at that point. It was like there was someone there just telling them that we're here for you. We got you. And don't do anything crazy. Like, it was just such a panic mode. And they saw it. They saw what we were doing, and they quickly went back. And I got to hand it to, like the people at Makers went back to Rob Samuels, the owner, and said, we can't. This isn't a loop. We got to get them more money. So by Tuesday morning, they called us and said, we're pulling our marketing funds from every region in America, and we're going to see if can you replicate this. And so I said, I have two people on staff, but I don't know. Sure. And so, you know, we called Nancy Silverton, was the first person we called, and we said, could you do this in LA? And she didn't even hesitate. She said, sure. So she started in LA. I activated my other restaurant in DC. So those were the first three markets. Then we went to Cincy, Eduardo Jordan in Seattle.
And so for each of those satellite markets, the concept was saying that they would need all the staff that they had to let go, the staffs and their families.
Yeah, and it wasn't the staff that they let go. It was now it turned into it's anyone in the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. Anyone. It's your the bartender at your local dive bar. It's, you know, the dishwasher at your family pizzeria joint that you take your family to on Sunday night, like anyone. And it turned out like in Louisville, as well as in LA and in New York, like it's a lot of immigrants, you know, a lot of immigrants are coming in and they're the ones that are most desperately in need. So Maker said, okay, here's the cities we need to, you know, it's a marketing budget. So they basically said, here are the cities we got money from. Can you go back to those cities and activate kitchens?
Did any chefs reach out to you and say, hey, Ed, how did you do this?
Yes. Yes, they have been. And you know, when I have the free time, we basically send them our blueprints and we send them our thing. And basically, you know, anyone in the food business now is dying. It's just dying. People who are in the liquor business, you know, they're not doing great, but they have surplus. They have a little bit of money. And we've been seeing it. You know, Tito's has been giving, Jameson has been giving. And it's just a perfect partnership right now. They have money. They need to do something. Anyone that's in restaurants are dying, and there are people that are hungry. And so we need to activate kitchens so that kitchens can employ people. And then from the people, they can feed the hungry. And so the more we can get money from corporations, and I don't care if it comes from Whole Foods or you know, Tito's or, you know, Makers, like, but Makers was the first one that jumped on board and said, we got to do this. We got to do this nationwide. And so in 6 days, we've now activated in 11 cities.
Nancy Silverton in LA, Eduardo Jordan in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Who else?
Paul Kahan in Chicago.
Bird and Avec and everything.
Yeah, he's doing it at a Big Star in Wicker Park.
Okay.
Linton Hopkins is doing it in Atlanta. Sorry, Donald Link is doing it in New Orleans. Ryan LaShane is just going to activate in Houston in like the next 2 days. Greg Backstrom is in Brooklyn, New York, as well as Nate Adler at Gertie's, which is just a, you know, we feel like, and we're actually trying to get more New York money for New York because it just New York's a beast. I mean, and there's no way that one or two kitchen is going to make even a dent in New York. So we're trying to see what we can do over there. But we're also trying to, you know, inspire other restaurants across the city to do a similar thing. You know, if they can find the seed money, here's the way I financed it. Here's the way I blueprinted it. You can follow that model. And even for the ones that are in my program, you know, what I do is a guideline. What we say is, listen, you know, your community is better than me. You know, like in Louisville, we hand out diapers. We hand out hundreds of diapers every day because it's mostly families. You know, not so in New York and LA. You know, they have different needs. So they're finding, they're pivoting and doing whatever they need for their community. And that's fine. You know, we're all just trying to do our best for these restaurant workers. And it's heartbreaking, man. There's so many people out there, you know, and there's so, it's not like, there's no city that's immune to this. And so chefs are calling from every city going, hey, I need help too. And I'm like, I know. San Antonio needs help. Memphis needs help. You know, like every fucking city needs help.
How do you sort of reconcile that in your own head, knowing that you've done amazing work thus far in a short time, but there's still this mountain of work to be done that
you yourself
can't do by yourself.
Nothing. No, but it's a coalition, you know, and we're seeing, I mean, obviously Jose Andre is doing incredible work through his Kids Central Kitchen. So he's expanding. And now there are grassroots things popping up all over. You know, listen, even if some guy opens up a soup kitchen and feeds 50 people, it's great, you know, but we have to like, when this first started, everyone thought, okay, we'll be on lockdown for 2 weeks and it'll be cool. And then all of our unemployment insurance will come in and we'll be fine. And what we're slowly or quickly finding out is that's not the case. Every single day, it seems like this is a 4 to 6 week lockdown. You know, all of my employees filed for unemployment on the first day and it crashed the system. Infrastructure is not there. I don't know how long it's going to take. Yes, they'll get the money, but when? Will it be 2 weeks? Will it be 4 weeks? You know, when will they actually have that cash in hand? And in the meantime, today is the first day that my employees don't get their checks, right? So they miss their paycheck. That's when panic starts to really set in, you know, and that's when people do desperate things. We have to all help each other because the next level of chaos after this is really scary. When people think there's no hope at all. And that's when society starts to break down and we just can't have that.
Yeah. I mean, on the one upside, you know, late last night, the $2 trillion stimulus plan passed and a lot of your colleagues like Tom Colicchio and Andrew Carmellini and Sam Cass were working really hard on that. And they're hopeful that at least in the long run, it'll help you guys get back on your feet once this pandemic passes. I'm curious about the here and now. I mean, you're talking about a highly contagious disease. We just got word this morning that Floyd Cardo's staff passed away from the coronavirus. How nervous are you when you're out and about and you're with people and it's like, you know, we're being told to social distance and isolate, and yet you're sort of on the ground working every day?
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. You put the safety of your workers at risk too. And that's part of the deal. One of the things that with this program, and we ask, and all the restaurants are the same, and everyone is the same. We tell every one of my staff every single day. I remind them. I said, anytime you want to quit this, go home. It's okay. And there's no sense of like you're quitting. There's no sense. It's like anytime you feel any doubt, it's okay. Like go home. Take care of yourself. Take care of your family. If you feel like this is getting too much, a mental strain, an obligation. If you can't deal with it, it's fine. We'll figure it out. There's nothing against you at all.
But it's a complicated decision because it's not just about the employee, but if that employee, like you said, you know, if they got a wife or child or husband and kids, like it's a family decision because everyone's at risk theoretically.
It is. Someone said this, I had a meeting this morning and someone said, we're flying the plane as we build it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're doing. And every day we're pivoting. And now we've gotten to the point where our next plan of action might be to stop cooking the hot meals to go and to just packaging to-go kits, you know, dry pasta, tomato sauce, cheese. And so now you need less people. Mm-hmm. You can really do, you can hand out 500 meals with like three people. So every single day we're adjusting, we're watching the news, we're pivoting, we're making sure that our first and foremost concern is the safety of our employees and everyone that's there, and also the people that are coming to us and waiting online, that we're having rules. And I will say, for the most part, with like, you know, literally a handful of exceptions, and we're feeding 300, 400 people a night. Every single person is following the rules, being very respectful of each other, just being very orderly and very grateful. So we're grateful for that. It's something I can't personally, you know, my staff and I and Lindsay, like, we don't think about it as much. And part of it on a personal level for me is that I feel like if I don't stop making 400 phone calls away a day, I'll fall into such a depression that I just have to keep this going. I have to feel like, you know, when you, I think especially for chefs, we're such independent people. We never ask for help. We never, you know, we're the ones always helping. And there's a sense of such helplessness right now that, you know, for me personally, I just need to keep this going for my own mental sanity, because the alternative is pretty dark.
Well, for you listeners out there, if you want to help Ed, you can go to leeinitiative.org. That's leeinitiative.org, where you can donate, correct, Ed?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, if anyone wants to, like, it has a hookup with supplies or anything, that just contact us through Facebook or through Instagram or any of our accounts. There are ways you can help out with supply donations and not necessarily cash donations, because we need those too.
All right. Well, Ed, thank you so much for taking the time, and keep doing amazing work.
All right. Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Cheers, Ed. Bye-bye.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.